broadcasting around the entire world. From Brooklyn, New York, via Simplecast, and supported by listeners like you. Varian, blockchains, crypto, interviews, funding, markets, shilling, panels, promises, lies. Keeping you up to date on everything crypto. Welcome to Thriller, Ethereal Summit. Now here is your host, Carl Gonzalez.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls from around the world. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Thriller Crypto Ethereal Summit Edition. My name is Carr Gonzalez, and we are broadcasting live, that's right, from New York in a Brooklyn hotel room. No, seriously, it was day two of Ethereal Summit, and I must say, if I was bullish on decentralization yesterday, well, I'm just convinced today. No, they started off the second day with some really good eye-opening sessions. We were kind of talking about how this was going to become the future yesterday. And today it almost felt like the future was already happening around us. We had VMware talk about their blockchain service that they're going to be releasing here pretty soon. We also had Microsoft come on stage talking about where they've been, where they're going, and how blockchain is a part of their DNA. We had some really bullish news on the institutional front from Mike Novogratz, who was talking about how the bulls are back in town and how we're almost there when it comes to this emerging space. Now, I will say, by far, it was a busier day today than yesterday. And by far, I think it was a stronger day for Ethereum in general. If you look at the markets, they're completely up right now. It's good all the way around. The very first speaking I want to discuss is one that I didn't see coming as being as surprising and informative as it was. It's Casey Schwab, the VP and Business and Legal Affairs of the NFL Players Association. That's right. And Jeff Marcello, Senior Vice President of New Media by the NBA. Now, this panel was called A Race for First Place, Blockchain Tech and Sports. And yeah, there's a lot of good touching points here. Check this out.
I don't want to predict what will be first. I think we talked about collectibles, and I think that's relatively low-hanging fruit because it's very additive. It doesn't necessarily have to mean we have to rip anything out and replace it. Ticketing is really interesting, too, because it both protects the fan in terms of assuring the authenticity of the tickets, but it also gives us a kind of a second-order effect of allowing us to participate in potentially in the secondary market. That's an interesting one, but it could be a little bit more disruptive. I talked before about the fact that we are, as a league, we're a network of partnerships and a network of players and a network of fans. And I think at some point soon, we'll explore how we create a next generation of loyalty program where every decision, every activity you make as a fan gets recognized across all of our partnerships, whether you're buying a basketball at a retail store or watching a TV, a game on a TV, or tweeting about us. It gets recognized as part of your fan profile, and you can be rewarded for it, and we can have more of a direct relationship with those fans across all of those connections. I won't say that that's soon, but I think it's really interesting, and I think we'll eventually see something like that.
Thank you. Casey?
Yeah, mine goes back to what I said first, which is solving a problem. One of the big problems in our world is counterfeit jerseys. So you have these two buckets. You have jerseys, which the counterfeit problem is massive. The FBI estimates like a minimum of a third of NFL jerseys are fraudulent. And it's insane to think that one out of three jerseys that people are wearing on the street are unlicensed. And therefore, obviously, we're not getting our royalties. The leagues aren't getting their royalties. The second bucket, you mentioned the Giants, is memorabilia. And when we talk about the benefits of the blockchain, it's all about immutability and eliminating trust, or creating trust through digital technology to eliminate the need for trust between human beings. Eli Manning, quarterback for the New York Giants, who I hope you're still a fan, despite the last few years.
Lifelong. Okay, they gave me good. Two titles in my lifetime. It's pretty good.
Good. So Eli was embroiled in a lawsuit a few years ago, settled in 2018 over game-worn memorabilia, in which the plaintiffs of the lawsuit, the consumers, sued Eli, amongst other folks, his agents, to say they weren't game-worn. So when I think about blockchain, you don't have to know anything about sports. If you're in the room now and you're thinking about, okay, a game-worn shirt, well, it's pretty easy to apply, or at least theoretically apply, blockchain to that game-worn item. So if and when there's ever a claim by anyone that it's not actually game-worn, you can look back and you can say, no. There's a geotag, time-stamped entry onto the blockchain that, by the way, for all these other reasons, is immutable, that on that day, after that game, Eli took off his jersey, handed it to an equipment manager, and the equipment manager took out his or her phone and uploaded it onto the blockchain. And then each step along the way, that jersey from the equipment manager, there's probably two or three steps in the middle to getting to the retailer selling that jersey. And then the critical part is the consumer then buys it. Consumer pulls out his or her phone, takes a snapshot of it, and can see that digital record. So it does a couple things. The first thing that would do is create trust and eliminate those problems that give me heartburn, like our players getting sued over game-worn memorabilia that's not really game-worn. That's huge. It's a huge problem, and solving the problem first is, I think, more than half the battle for integrating new technologies into corporate America. But secondly, what that does is it creates more value for that item. So it creates a value for that individual item that person, that consumer, can now go to the world and say, I own this jersey. And I can show to the world that I own this jersey. And anybody who wants to buy this jersey can now find me and know that it's authentic via this platform, this secondary platform. If you're familiar with StockX, Dan Gilbert's StockX sneakers, authenticated sneakers and other items. Why isn't that model being applied in sports memorabilia? And we've been working on this, as Brad knows, for almost 2 years now. So I went to the first two, this solving the problem, increasing the value of that individual item. There's a third benefit. If you were to type in Tom Brady autographed football into eBay right
now. Who's
that? The other guy.
Yeah, there we go.
The other guy. Daniel Jones autograph sneakers. How about that?
Much better. Thank you.
You're going to go on eBay, and you're going to see all sorts of prices. And any user, and this is not a knock on eBay, but any user is going to know that there's a risk. There's some percentage of risk that item that they purchase might not be real.
So can I ask you...
Yeah.
Why not use, I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate, but why not use a centralized database for this? I mean, I think most people who are purchasing this memorabilia trust the NFLPA or trust the NFL. If you guys were to operate a centralized database for this, wouldn't you get most of the way there?
In a perfect world in which we trusted all of our agents and our marketing reps and our managers that and the cousin and the mom and the brother and the neighbor around our athletes, if we could trust them, absolutely. But we're not in a perfect world. So there are, when you talk about, you mentioned like all these different entities in the ecosphere of sports. So when I think about that, just for this specific use case, I think you got the athlete. And a little bit of it is protecting him against himself, right? That's part of this. I'm not gonna go any further on that. But protecting him against himself, so you have the athlete. You have the equipment manager or whoever works for the club. Then you have the group of people around the athlete. Then you have the manufacturer / retailer seller of the item. So we sit in the middle of it, which is both good and bad. So to your point, I think consumers would trust an NFLPA seal on these items. But we don't control the whole supply chain. There's at least 6, if not more, steps before it gets to the consumer. And we can draft contracts, we can have them sign affidavits, we can do certs of authenticity and do all these enforcement things. But until we can ensure it digitally and really know and eliminate that need for trust of other human beings, I'm not sure that does get us there.
You know, I have to commend Casey there for actually stepping into that question. We hear that a lot. Why not just create a central database, right? And he answered exactly why they can't do that. It was pretty eye-opening to see it from their perspective, to understand why they do the way they do things the way they do. Another thing I will kind of really kind of was shocked by. Well, not really. I mean, I think we all know how the NFL is portrayed in the media and how the NBA is portrayed in the media. It was interesting to hear how the NBA is more, you know, tailored to helping out and making the fan experience more enjoyable. And somebody like the NFL is more looking about how to make sure that everything, you know, is very tight and structured and all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of fascinating to see the two different sides and the struggles that they have. Okay, so the next piece of audio I want you to take a listen to, and this is important. This is very important because Microsoft Azure blockchain is going to be a thing. It just is, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a thing. It's going to be a part of your technology stack that you're going to have to deal with, either if you're managing it or if you're going to be developing on it. It's going to become a thing, and ultimately, it'll be a service that everybody uses, I would imagine, if they don't choose the Hyperledger route. So take a listen to York Rhodes as he kind of looks at the road ahead at measuring where Microsoft was, where it is now, and how they continue to experiment and try to adopt and transform all in the same decade. It wasn't too long ago when they were ruling the entire world. They still are to a certain degree, but now they're playing catch up. Check this out.
Some interesting things happened in 1995. For those people that weren't around, obviously the 90s was the very similar era of where we are now in blockchain, which is people are discovering blockchain, people were discovering the internet at the time, companies didn't know why they wanted to be on the internet even when it was possible to be on the internet, and consumers really didn't know why they wanted to be on the internet either because there was really nothing on the internet for consumers. So in 1995, this really interesting thing happened, it happened to actually, you know, sort of be coincident with things that Microsoft was doing in the space. When this thing called Windows 95 happened, it was actually in 1995, the most prescient thing that happened in 1995 with Windows 95 was that Microsoft decided to not have the default networking stack be the dominant enterprise stack at the time, which was NetWare, from a company called Novell. Probably don't know any of those words. Microsoft decided that they were going to make TCP/IP, the protocol of the internet, be the default networking protocol within Windows 95. So Windows 95 as a consumer operating system shipped to consumers. Consumers now had the ability to effectively be on the web, again, whether they cared about it or not. So my thesis is that we're sort of at that moment in time. The technology is there. Consumers may not care. Enterprises may not know why they care. But everybody's sort of churning through all of the great work that the startups are doing, that we're working with, including some of the ones that you've seen here this weekend. And so basically, people ran to the store and they said, oh my God, I can be on web too. No, they didn't, right? They actually had no idea what web 2 was, right? So it's sort of an important similar place that we are now. Like, does anybody know what web 3 is? Does anyone really care what Web3 is? Well, that's blockchain technology, right? So do people care about blockchain? Yes. Do people care about crypto? Yes, right? Why do they care about crypto? Why do they care about blockchain? Do we even know why we care, right? And so 95% of the population doesn't really know, right? So this is the same thing that happened with the internet. But there are some technologies that are actually making the Web3 stack accessible to consumers. So we're at this tipping point, in my view, in 2019, where mass-produced technology products and companies are coming to market with capability in them, whether or not consumers care about it, because those corporations have made smart decisions. So Samsung is a great example of that. Samsung has a huge worldwide population of users, and the S10 actually has a Web3 crypto wallet in it. Now, I have problems that we call it crypto wallets. It's one of those default words, like, why do I need a crypto wallet as a consumer? Well, you need a Web3 wallet, right? And so a crypto wallet's a Web3 wallet. And so that's actually a big, big deal from a tipping point perspective. Prior to this, there were some nascent mobile technology companies that actually had done this, but nobody knew the names of those companies. So now when you have a company like Samsung with massive market share and people are going to go out and buy the S10 in droves, now you've got people who are actually there, consumers who are there, and then people will build for that. So there's an important tipping point happening. The other side of this, obviously, is we need application stacks, whether they're browsers or mobile application stacks. And Opera is actually leading the way here as a relatively well-known, although small market share, browser company. They've built, similarly, a Web3 wallet or a crypto wallet into their browser. It's actually the one I've been using for the last couple of months because not having the Samsung S10 phone yet, I'm still on S9, which I only bought like 9 months ago. So I'm trying to justify the upgrade. The Opera browser was very accessible, and what I found was that the onboarding experience into Web3 through the Opera browser was actually quite painless. And that is a really important thing as we look at how do these technologies get in the hands of consumers. The other vector that Opera will drive is based on the Chromium standard, or quote-unquote standard, that Microsoft Edge is now also based on, and all the other browsers pretty much are based on that same standard. This is going to drive us to every other browser manufacturer saying, hey, I got to do that too. Right, so once you got all the browsers on board and you got mobile devices on board, well, now you've got consumers, right? Consumers drive enterprise and application developer behavior. So those are really important tipping points on this journey. And then you have interesting other tipping points that are happening, which is, this is actually in Rockefeller Center. You come up the escalator from the subway and you hit a bookshelf that's basically full of books about blockchain. This is like zeitgeist type of stuff, right? It's starting to get past, hey, I really want crypto to blockchain is interesting. What is this thing, right? It's in some ways you might say like the internet, right, is now the blockchain, right, in terms of how people might start to think about that in an number of years. So this actually is an interesting time of year for Microsoft as well, not just because of New York City Blockchain Week, but we have our developer conference every year, usually in April or May. And for Microsoft, which is a fairly large corporation, you might have heard of it, we have about 9 million developers that we address as basically customers of Microsoft developer tools. So 9 million developers is pretty large, right, compared to the hundreds of thousands of developers in the blockchain ecosystem, right? So this is another tipping point where we can, as an enterprise, really create leverage to help those 9 million developers actually get onboarded into how to do development in a Web3 world. So we had, and I'll go through this a little bit, over the past couple years since I started our journey and Microsoft started our journey in 2015, that's 4 years ago for anyone who's counting, we actually had some pretty good presence this year. If anyone knows who Virgil Griffith is, he's on the Ethereum Foundation. He was actually at our developer conference because of some of the work we're doing with the Ethereum Foundation. And so let me go back to this question. Like, when can first of all, consumers will never celebrate being on a Web3 stack, but when? Right? When does it matter to them? Besides like the technical foundation, it matters when, you know, they can do things like essentially order a coffee through a mobile app, right? That's when it matters to them. It doesn't really matter to them that the technology is there yet, right? So there's still work to do on the application side, but it's one of the things that, you know, we really do at Microsoft. And let me just take you very quickly through our journey, just through some PR stuff that you've seen. This is November 2015. This is our first public announcement about work we were doing in blockchain. It happened at DEF CON Zero. We announced something called blockchain as a service, which is a completely overused term. It wasn't a service, but it was blockchain. And in early 2016, we actually launched a Visual Studio plugin for Solidity, along with Vitalik and Andrew Keys and the consensus folks. And that other gentleman in the middle there is Satya Nadella, who's the CEO of Microsoft. So in 2016 and 2015, the Microsoft executives from the CEO down were well aware of what was going on in the work that we were doing in blockchain, but it takes a little time, right, as an enterprise. So I'm just gonna use the Build Developers Conference. Again, that number is wrong, actually. Michael Del Castillo, who published this article at CoinDesk, he's now at Forbes. I told him like the day after he published it that that's 9 million, not 3 million, just so the number is wrong. It's probably more than 9 million at this point. I'll skip a couple of years after we got organized in 2016. We didn't have any huge announcements in 2017. So 2018, we started to get to you know, some more capabilities. I don't know if anyone knows the HODL, BUILDL, SAFL, you know, type of terminology. I just modified the screenshots there a little bit. This is the CTO of Azure. So basically the guy who's the chief technologist for our cloud business in 2018 started actually talking about this in depth in his talks at Microsoft to these 9 million developers. And it's interesting because in his journey of learning, he started out where almost everyone starts out, which is like this thing called Bitcoin, which created awareness of digital uniqueness. So he actually used to spend a lot of time talking about that, and we're like, yeah, that's the boring part, Mark. You need to get past that and start talking about actual real application development on other platforms besides Bitcoin. So, you know, people were writing about this, obviously, in 2018. 2019, actually, this year, actually just earlier this week, the Microsoft Build Conference. We had some great presentations, a ton of stuff that's been shipped to market. If you're interested in finding it, just go search for Microsoft Blockchain. You'll see some of the stuff that I'm gonna talk about a little bit as we continue this talk. But one of the great things that we did because of the work we're doing with the Ethereum Foundation is we actually had Vitalik come back 2 years later to the Microsoft Build Conference and actually get on stage with Mark Rusinovich, our CTO of Azure, and, you know, do some demos, do some talks like this particular one, just around, you know, how we're collaborating together in the ecosystem. So from a Microsoft perspective and sort of my perspective, how I justify my work at a large enterprise in the blockchain space is we're really trying to help enterprises cross this chasm, right? This unknown thing that they're scared of, just like people were scared of the internet in the mid-90s. So we did some announcements with Starbucks this week. The Starbucks announcement actually was specifically about coffee provenance, so bean to cup. Verifying that your Ethiopian coffee was actually grown in Ethiopia by a farmer, potentially being able to tip the farmers and things like that, so to the extent that you want to. And we've done a bunch of work across different industries, a couple of different ones in the airline space, both on the consumer loyalty side with Singapore Airlines, as well as on the cargo side. And these are just some really brief samples to give you a sense. I spend a great deal of time in the humanitarian sector, so both on the identity side as well as on the blockchain side. And this is actually a recent event that I participated in called the Blockchain for Social Good Summit with about 22 other NGOs exploring how blockchain is interesting for what they're trying to achieve in their mission. And then this week as well, we made a big announcement with JP Morgan, specifically about Quorum, which is the blockchain stack. It's an Ethereum stack. And basically, Quorum is also a huge enterprise customer of Microsoft, so it made a lot of sense for Microsoft to do a great deal of work with JP Morgan. They've got a lot of internal enterprise stuff that they're doing, in addition to the blockchain team specifically there as well. And if you look at, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see sometimes I get into arguments with people. nice arguments. But this goes back to the point, like, people often say, like, well, what's going on? This, you know, blockchain is crazy. You know, you heard John Wolpert yesterday. Oh, here he is. Talking about the mainnet, which philosophically I agree with, right? Like, if you do enterprise consortium blockchain, it's fundamentally not as decentralized as something like the Ethereum mainnet. But it also is a way to help enterprises cross the chasm, right? So back to my justification, right? You have to sort of walk large conservative enterprises across the chasm. And in fact, great examples are, you know, companies like Ernst & Young and Microsoft. Although Microsoft likes to be a disruptor in technology, they're both fundamentally large conservative organizations, right? So the fact that they're doing the things that they're doing in the blockchain space and embracing this amorphous concept of decentralization is actually quite important as a metric of a tipping point. And as I said, we've been doing this for quite some time.
Yeah, and that was York talking about how Microsoft and the industry is trying to penetrate every single part of this thing. They really are. And one thing that I don't think was played in there was that 95% of the people out there in the world don't care about blockchain or crypto. They just want it to make it, they just want it to be easier. It needs to be faster, easier, more transparent than the way things are now. And even then, if it's not seamless and sticky, it won't penetrate. But it's good to have people like Microsoft and VMware and a whole group of them behind this whole movement that we have going on here. It's good. It's all good news. Now, one of the next pieces of this kind of decentralized movement is open source. For the most part, a lot of the talk about decentralization and about blockchain is coming from within ConsenSys. And there is a new project, and its founder and CEO Kevin Urwacki is trying to create something that will not only help open source, but might even give it the lifeblood it's always needed. Now, the name of the project is Gitcoin, but you have to remember that in order for open source to be profitable, it has to be maintained. And in order to be maintained, you're going to need to support it. And he thinks he's figured out how to do that with Gitcoin. Check this out.
Massively more than anyone else. We've tried to ask them nicely to pay for their use of open source software. We've tried putting donation buttons on our platforms. We've tried using bounties. We've tried using open core. There's 20 years of prior art in open source sustainability, and it hasn't really had a ton of effect. And that's expressed in this chart that says that the top methods of funding open source software is self-funding or no funding, or an employer, or consulting. So it's not really working. I think that we can do better. And I think that you should have hope that this is going to change. And it's because of the design space of blockchain and open source software. So from first principles, we value open source software. And with programmable money, we can program our values into our money. and therefore we can make open source profitable to maintain. The internet brought 1,000x use of information services to the world. Before the internet, you would never send a postcard to your coworker a few cubes down and ask them if they want to go get lunch with you, but you would send that IM today because it's faster and cheaper to send information messages because of the internet. And I think that if there's 1,000x use of financial services, then we can have a breakthrough application of finance that's fundamentally new and native to the Internet of Money that's going to support open source. And the tangible reason why it's going to change is that there's $100 to $900 billion in market cap of these crypto networks, and they're all looking for software developers. They all need to bring software developers into their ecosystem. They all need to fund open source software. And everything is increasingly built as open source. So all the money that used to go to some back office on Wall Street is now going to open source software, and that's going to change how we fund software development. The dream for us at Gitcoin is that Gitcoin becomes a Swiss Army knife that solves this problem. And we view this as a funnel. So the open source contributor lifecycle that I told you about, the burnout lifecycle, means that most people use open source software, but they rarely contribute to it or maintain it. So the engineer in me loves the optimization problem here. We just create a crypto economic force that accelerates what's working in open source software, and then we just decelerate what's not working. It's simple, it's an optimization problem. Gitcoin's way of doing this is as a double-sided market that connects people who fund open source software to coders who need funding for their open source software. And they're trading access to the developers for things that have financial value. And we've got fresh pow on both sides of the market. That's just what we call inventory in Colorado. The dev community being on the coder side, we've got 20K software developers that are looking to work on your software development repos. And we've got money that we've bundled from the EF consensus grants and others that is looking to be deployed to software development. We've done about over $1 million worth of work in the space with some of the top projects in the space. And so that's the sort of like Gitcoin portion of the talk. I want to end for my last 5 minutes by talking really briefly about six options that I'm really excited about that are fundamentally new to the blockchain internet that I think could change the way that open source is funded. So the first, it's worth stating the status quo, is benevolent billionaires or corporations, which we rely on that they have hope for the common good, that they're funding open source software and are working on things that provide value to the world and adhere to our values. And these can offer, benevolent billionaires and corporations can offer millions in investment, but there's a capture problem. I think that I'm very lucky to be working at Consensus where we've got Joe Lubin at the helm and he's got a fundamentally optimistic view of the world. But you can't rely on that from every billionaire that's out there. If you see any of these people walking down the street, ask them to fund your open source project. Boy, what a transition, huh? So this is Moloch DAO. You guys heard yesterday that they are a minimum viable DAO that uses donations and a membership tracking smart contract on the Ethereum blockchain to deploy grants to the ecosystem. So we're using the blockchain technology to deploy capital to people who are building blockchain technology, which has various levels of meta to it. But the tangible thing is that they've raised $1 million as of yesterday. And there's a governance mechanism here that allows you to rage quit if you're a member of this organization and you don't agree with how the funding is used. And I think it's quite an elegant solution that Amin, if you're out there, you put it together, kudos to you. A new fundamentally different way of raising money for open source software was suggested by Vitalik about 2 months ago. I'll save you reading the tweet. He proposed a community norm, so it's opt-outable if you want to, where we just include a 1 gig away fee to our wallets if we when we send a transaction on the network. And that 1 gig away fee in aggregate could provide $2 million per dollars per year in open source sustainability. And I think that it's a 1,000x use case of blockchain. We send thousands of transactions on the Ethereum network, and it's just really exciting to see that that we could support open source by just building in a community norm like that into our wallets. I am on the working group for something that's called Block Rewards Funding, first introduced formally in EIP 1789, which I'm the author of, which would propose a 10% increase in the amount of block rewards that come off of the Ethereum blockchain. So basically, every block that's minted on the Ethereum blockchain, every 15 seconds, there's 2 ETH that goes to miners in exchange for the work that's done to secure the Ethereum network. And so the idea here is, well, what if we have software developers who are writing the software that secures the Ethereum network? Why shouldn't we be paying them also? Well, the answer is that the miners' work is very verifiable. So when someone does work, we have this algorithm called proof of work, which says that they did the work and they should get paid. But with software development, the value proposition is inherently abstract and you can't measure it in 15 second chunks. Sometimes you can't even measure it in multi-month chunks because the value proposition for software is inherently abstract. I could think something's valuable. You don't think that something's valuable. There is no proof of work for block rewards. And so it's become sort of controversial. There's a governance problem here and we're working through that stuff over the longer time frame in the block rewards funding group. If you want to learn more, you can join our Telegram group and give us a piece of your mind. There's a project within the Gitcoin portfolio called CodeFund, which provides recurring passive revenue from non-tracking contextual ads. And basically the deal is that CodeFund bundles up ad inventory from DigitalOcean, from Rollbar, from Segment, other clients that want to advertise to software developers, specifically blockchain software developers, and then allows you to put a piece of JavaScript on your documentation or your web presence, which if you're a maintainer of open source, you probably have a decent web presence, and allows you to monetize that audience that you have without selling them out. The key thing here is that it's ethical advertising. So if you're an open source software developer, you're a sophisticated internet consumer, you do not want to sell out your audience to Facebook and Google to make a buck. CodeFund provides an option for you to monetize your open source software reputation without selling your audience and make almost as much as you would on Google and Facebook, which is a way out of this trap of open source not being funded. There's a project called OS Coin, which is basically what they did was they took PageRank, the algorithm that uses metadata in the web to figure out which websites are valuable, and applies that to open source software. So basically in the web, if a link goes from one page to another, that's a vote that that page is important. And in open source, if your repo depends on another repo, then that's a vote that the upstream repo is important. So we can construct an OS rank for every single open source repo that exists in the web, and then we can distribute rewards programmatically to the top ones out there. And this could potentially, when they eventually release their token, be a $1 million distribution to open source software, and it could continue over time as they mint new blocks. The last project that I want to tell you about is Gitcoin Grants, which is basically a decentralized Patreon, which uses EIP 1337, the LEET standard, the LEET standard is basically the subscription standard on the Ethereum blockchain. And what we do with Gitcoin Grants is we allow you to set up a crowdfunding page where you can do...
Yeah, they're doing some amazing stuff at Consensus, and Gitcoin is just one of them. I highly recommend checking them out. It's fascinating just how intelligent these guys are, and ladies as well, too. It really is. They're really on point with a lot of things. The very last talk I want to discuss is Joe Lubin's keynote. And it was kind of, I don't know if you saw the recent articles from CoinDesk talking about it. Joe went up there and he was kind of giving a retrospective from the other side of the trust revolution. And it was taking place from like the year 2047. I thought it was pretty straightforward the way it was perceived, but it seems to me that a lot of people just missed it entirely. I know there were certain people that kind of shrugged it off and didn't understand exactly what he was trying to say. But kind of from what I saw and from what I was understanding from it, it was very reminiscent to how Arthur C. Clarke would describe the future. I don't know if you are a fan of Arthur C. Clarke or if you know of the history of him or read of any of his essays, but he always would talk about this ever-present future that's coming. And today, Joe Lubin did that. And now, come to think of it, he's kind of always done that. In past interviews that I've seen him in, and even at South By, when I saw him at South By, he kind of gave this forward-thinking kind of trajectory when it came to not only Ethereum, but this whole decentralized blockchain movement. And he kind of built on these concepts and these constructs that are going to get torn down, and this machine economy and Web 4.0 and all this stuff that's going to be coming. But some people just didn't understand it. Some people just heard certain key trigger things in there and kind of took it out of context. But, you know, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can do everything you can to explain things to people, but you can't listen for them. And even sometimes by explaining what's going on and where his angle was, it's still not enough. So yeah, I think CoinDesk just got it wrong. But take a listen for yourself. Here's Joe Lubin talking about Ethereal Summit in a 30-year retrospective in the year 2047, looking back on yesteryear.
Thank you all for being here on this ethereal evening of May 11th, 2047, in the great sovereignty of Brooklyn. Every year at the Ethereal Festival, I reflect on what we've accomplished the year before, share milestones and offer thoughts for what the next year might bring. This year, 30 years after Ethereal's inauguration in 2017, instead of doing my usual State of Consensus keynote, I wanted to take this occasion to look back, do a retrospective, take stock of where we were at the start of this odyssey, revisit some of the more memorable milestones along the way, and take a moment to be grateful. This is the 30th anniversary of an event that was initially formulated to bring the artists, thinkers, politicians, philosophers, and dreamers into what we then called the decentralized future, and what we recognize today as simply the new normal. And what a great, continually and dynamically regenerative normal it has become. Ethereal Festival this year is the best that I can remember. The talent on display of the artists, music acts, gamers, vid makers, and crypto economists, and the brilliance of all the speakers and panelists eclipses any recent Ethereal Week. Amanda, Jesse, and team, brilliantly done, and thank you. Despite being three decades in, you are still bringing that youthful excitement and edge to Ethereal. There are 52,391 humans here tonight, and another 303,499 intelligences processing this evening's proceedings. 46,332 of us are telepresent here tonight. 1,193 meat sacks are here in the room. Thank you for joining us in person. Of those of you who transported in, 376 arrived by SpaceX, one-third through the atmosphere and two-thirds on the VAC train. And 430 of you live in the metro area. In the hunter-gatherer age, the size of your tribe, your lifelong social network, was less than Dunbar's number of 150. When it gave way to the agrarian age, societies grew larger and required a transformation in how we organize for collective action. Until recently, the trust infrastructure of human society hadn't fundamentally changed since then, some 10,000 years ago. Every modern economic age has been driven by explosive technological innovation, resulting in increased efficiency, throughput, and coordination. Each economic revolution resulted in systems and technologies that raised the quality of life for so many. But all these developments have rested on a single, somewhat weak foundation, the subjective base trust layer of our societies. People need to trust one another in order to do basic things together. Historically, all of the base trust layers in our societies have been founded on subjective trust. Trust in single individuals or interpersonal networks, trust in platforms like businesses and institutions, or trust in large centralized authorities like governments. This works well in many situations, but often breaks down when there's a misunderstanding, information asymmetry, or imbalance of power. Reliance on centralized trust enabled certain kinds of intermediaries to extract excessive value from transaction flows. Rents were extracted largely for imbuing relationships with necessary trust, standing between content creators, service or resource providers, and their customers. In the early 2000s, a movement emerged to redefine the foundation of trust. In 2001, a technology-driven political movement based on peer-to-peer computer networks was triggered by BitTorrent and the Kademlia technology, enabling file-sharing networks to be decentralized. In 2009, with Bitcoin 1.0, when we married the new field of crypto economics with blockchain database technology on peer-to-peer networks, we discovered that maximally decentralized replicated state machines were the key to building a new trust foundation for the planet. If everyone had their own guaranteed accurate copy of what happened and when, nobody could cheat the system. Things kicked into gear in 2014 with Ethereum 1.0. As an initially technological movement blossomed and bore fruit more quickly than we possibly could have imagined. All of this was pioneered first by tech nerds, then served as breeding grounds for next generation financial tooling and network platform business models. As the decentralized finance and future of work viruses infected the world, or should I say, inoculated it. Decentralized protocols like Ethereum and decentralized crypto economics, in synergy with the open source movement, have enabled us to usher in a new trust infrastructure for the planet, one that anchors the Web3 protocols that secure the P2P economy and the P2M systems, as well as the Web4 M2M protocols, the machine economy, all of which has enabled perhaps the most profound, positive, and rapid transformation in human history, the decentralized trust revolution. Up to the 2030s, our society was run by intermediaries in nearly every industry: monarchs, governments, banks, central counterparties, central points of collection and distribution. These were the entities that controlled the choke points. Controlling those points where materials, skills, and information were gathered and meted out, created the bulk of wealth and power. It was usually not the creators and creatives that were able to retain and monetize most of the value created, as they had different kinds of skills and talents. The fabric of society was a tapestry of top-down command and control systems, with gatekeeper intermediaries controlling the interfaces between those hierarchies. Knowing exactly which throat to choke enabled the justice system to function. The age-old subjective trust foundation enabled or necessitated business models that were nearly always fundamentally exploitative, as few business people possessed the integrity to operate them honorably. Today, in the networked platform economy of 2047, where metaphors like which throat to choke are antithetical, such intermediaries no longer need be relied on to imbue transactions with trust. This is handled by the trust platforms themselves. Intermediaries are no longer in a position to extract an outsized portion of the value created. We still have layers of intermediaries populating our open platforms, our value chains, and our transaction flows, but these new intermediaries are creative, add new information, eliminate frictions, and reduce costs. In the age of decentralized trust platforms, the content creators, the resource and service providers are directly connected to their consumers and are compensated appropriately. Success is less about transactional business skills. creativity, and novel problem solving are rewarded. In the teens and the early 20s, the Web 2 internet companies grew too powerful. Leaders of those companies were called to testify before governments, but to little avail. In a sense, these companies were in their teens themselves, their adolescences, with the hormonal power of unbridled technology coursing through their veins, but without the wisdom to temper the use of it. The technologies they wielded caused them to be nearly ungovernable. They were too strong, brash, and moved too fast, with underdeveloped ethics. These companies were able to monetize bigger and faster than ever before, and they were able to change the rules through lobbying and manipulation of public opinion. This power derived from their control of vast swaths of cultural, social, political, and economic data that we had all sometimes willingly and often unwillingly given them.
Yeah, I was pretty fascinated with all the kind of places he went in regards to his keynote. A couple of things that kind of stuck out was he had referenced a Solaris platform, wondering what that is. And then it was also interesting he had mentioned Fedcoin and how it's backed by commodities and that they will trade Fedcoin for USD, the government that is, and then burn the USD. It was very reminiscent. I'm just going to say it was very reminiscent again of Arthur C. Clarke. And he really emphasized that. Don't just wait for the future. Help build it. And that's kind of something that I live my life by, being here in Austin and doing my part with my community. And of course, being a part of the crypto industry and doing my part with that as well, too. It's all about moving this space forward for the next generation and the generation after that. It's not so much about what can I do, what can I accomplish on my own. It's more about what can we do, what can we accomplish together. That was kind of what I got out of it. And the future is bright if we kind of have that mindset together as the entire space evolves. It's going to be very hard for us to push back against this old financial system that doesn't want to let loose of its chokehold that it has on the world. So, yeah. It was just an inspiring keynote, and hats off to the entire crew and company at Consensus and the people who put on the Ethereal Summit. They did a great job. And of course, shout out to Pace Publications, excellent PR company, great to deal with. And shout out to Breaker as well, too. Extremely, extremely nice people as well. And I think that's all I got. That's all I got for Ethereal Summit Day 2. It was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun these past 2 days talking to everybody in the space. And it's just every time I attend these things, it's always getting bigger. I feel like Ethereum is just, it's just doing great right now. I mean, it really is. Okay. With that, let's get on to the end of the show.
Who said you?
ladies and gentlemen, another Thriller Crypto is Dunsies. Thank you so much for listening. And you just listened to two Brooklyn bands, Parlor Walls and Russian Bass. They're pretty amazing, I think. Just remember, the space is looking so bullish right now. This is that yearly consensus pump, but I think it's turned into a blockchain week pump, to be honest with you. It's going to be interesting seeing what happens here on Monday. But stay tuned. We've got a couple more episodes to release here. Bye, Bitcoin. Say the world. See you tomorrow.
This is the end of the show. You have been listening to Thriller Podcast with Bar Gonzalez. Remember, Thriller Podcast is not financial advice. Everything Carr said likely won't come true. It is up to you. Now go, do your own research. Listen to other dudes that start their name with crypto, and not Carr. And remember, buy Bitcoin and save the world. One Satoshi at a time.